We're talking about education deserts here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. So geography is a really key player in college attendance. More than half of students at public four-year colleges grew up less than 50 miles from their campus. And the median community college student travels 8 miles to get to campus. That's from the Center for American Progress. Do you attend college close to home? How much of a role did location have in whether you went to college? Do you wish there were more options nearby you? Are you concerned that a UW campus in your community could close one day? We're at 800-642-1234. Kelly Meyerhofer covers higher education for the Wisconsin State Journal. Her recent article is called "Small UW Campuses Provide Access to Education. What Would Happen If They Disappeared?" Kelly, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thanks, Kate.
And Josh Bach-Hansen is here, a UW-Madison doctoral student in education, where his research focuses on access to and financing of higher education. Josh, welcome to you.
Thanks so much, Kate.
Well, let's start with what is an education desert. Kelly, how did you wrap your arms around this? What does it look like?
Well, there's no broadly accepted definition of an education desert. Researchers define it a couple different ways. And so I just turned to UW-Madison researchers and asked them to analyze like what the state would look like if any of the college campuses were to close.
And Josh, as you crunched those numbers and looked at that data and that mapping, what did you see there?
Yeah, so broadly, The education deserts in Wisconsin, already we have about 9 within Wisconsin, and that's centered around what we call commuting zones, which are just statistically derived zones that look at economic activity and generally are folks or areas that economic activity is intertwined. So folks live in these areas, they commute perhaps across counties, but they're clusters of counties. And there are about 9 clusters of counties in Wisconsin that are currently education deserts.
So these commuting zones, as you call them, where are they in our state?
So the education desert commuting zones are predominantly in northern Wisconsin. So thinking north of Wausau, that's where a lot of those education deserts currently are.
Yeah, when I looked at your map, I said, oh my gosh, the North Woods. Where are people going? Kelly, what did you see there?
We're in northern
Wisconsin.
In
the northern, yeah.
Well, I think for a lot of students, they have to go a lot further than maybe perhaps they would like. You know, there's UW-Eau Claire, UW-River Falls, UW-Stout, UW-Superior. Those are the main ones up there. And then there's some technical colleges as well.
So they really do have to leave their immediate area if they want to have access to higher ed.
Yeah, I mean, an education desert is a place that lacks easy access to higher education.
So if UW were to close any of its branch campuses, as your headline alluded to, what would happen? What would we see?
Well, first, I should point out that, the UW system says there's no conversations going on about any campus closures. If campuses were to close, though, I think that, the educational opportunities for people in these areas would diminish.
How much vitality, Josh, does a campus bring to a town or a community?
Yeah, that's hard to that's part of the work that we're doing in the Star Lab, which is a lab here on campus that I work in. And we look at this. It's really hard to quantify that within a community. And there's so much nuance within these rural communities that it's hard to say that if this happened, then this will happen based on what we currently have. So that's hard to know, just looking at data. But from personal experiences, from the work that Kelly does, getting into these communities, we know that these colleges play a really important role.
We're talking with Josh Bach-Hansen, a graduate student who's studying access to higher education. Kelly Meyerhofer is here as well, the Wisconsin State Journal's higher ed reporter, looking at communities with access to higher education and what happens in smaller communities. You can join in with your situation where you live, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Kelly, you talked with students who attend some of UW's smaller campuses. What did they tell you about their choices they've made?
Yeah, so I was fortunate enough to go out to UW-Platteville-Richland, which is between Madison and La Crosse. And students that I talked to there, many of them are from, you know, really small rural communities. There were older, more adult students or students who were still living at home to save money. Some were the first in their family to attend college. So it's a lot of what's known in higher education as non-traditional students. No one I talked to specifically said that, you know, if this campus, UW-Platteville-Richland, was not there, that they wouldn't go to college. You know, they said they would probably go to a technical college further away or maybe to UW-Platteville and have to live on campus, which would cost them a lot more money. So,
but proximity did play a role in the stories that you heard.
Yeah, yeah.
Your reporting found that last year, UW branch campuses had their lowest combined enrollment since 1973. Do we know why enrollment is declining?
Yeah, the number of traditional high school students that are graduating from Wisconsin high schools is just, it's been going down for several years. And I think there's a UW-Madison report that predicts that the number of high school students graduating this spring and going into college next fall is going to be the lowest since, I think, like 2000. So there's just fewer traditional students for colleges to recruit and bring to their campuses.
But you're really hearing the voices of non-traditional students in these outlying communities who really say that proximity is important. Josh, what do you find there in your research?
Yeah, so you referenced the Center for American Progress report that looks at about 50 miles for the average distance that students are traveling. Some of the work that my advisor, Nick Hillman, has done shows that about 2/3 of the students are even staying within 25 miles of home. So proximity is really, really important. That's really true in Wisconsin as well, where a rural student is less likely to go to a four-year campus than a suburban or urban peer.
Do we know anything about whether they stick with their programs in terms of if it's a campus closer by? You know, what do we see about matriculation?
Yeah, that's a good question. That I don't know off the top of my head what we have. I do know that students that are traveling, it is more of a burden, right? So Kelly referenced folks having to potentially live on campus, get meal plans, pay for additional travel costs, moving costs. Those are costs that add up pretty quickly for students. And for students who were thinking, oh, I'm going to stay home to or stay close to home, save up, and then maybe transfer into a four-year campus, be able to live a little bit more cheaply. It's a big deal if a campus were to close and they don't have that option anymore.
Kelly, does a strong economy like what we're seeing here have an impact on higher education enrollment?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's not something that I've looked at too much, but I've just heard in talking to experts in my work that, you know, when there's a recession, more people are looking to sort of shift careers and they go back to school. So, you know, the economy is stronger right now and that could affect, you know, the declining enrollment. But I think the main reason is the demographics.
And you follow enrollment so closely. Is enrollment growing at any of the campuses that you found?
At UW-Madison, you know, enrollment's gone up, and I think UW-Green Bay, their main campus, has gone up. But for the majority of campuses, for half of the branch campuses and a lot of the main campuses as well.
We're talking about access to college in rural counties of Wisconsin. Kelly Meyerhofer covers higher ed for the Wisconsin State Journal. Josh Bach-Hansen is a doctoral student researching access to higher ed. Do you wish you could attend a college near your home, but it doesn't offer the program you wish to study? Do you want more options for college near your home? How would your town manage if there were more access to college coursework? Join in at 800-642-1234. We'll pick this up with Kelly Meyerhofer and Josh Bach-Hansen in a moment here on the Ideas Network. If you're just joining us, we're looking at access to college in Wisconsin's rural areas. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Many Americans lack internet access. Roughly two-thirds of people in rural areas have broadband internet access in their homes. That's according to Pew Research. So attending college remotely online may not be an option. Do you attend college close to your home? How much of a role did that play in whether you went to college? Do you wish for more degree and training options nearby? Join in at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Josh Bach-Hansen is a doctoral student researching access to higher ed at UW-Madison. And Kelly Meyerhofer is here. She covers higher ed for the Wisconsin State Journal, and they stay with us. So, Kelly, how have the mergers that you've seen with the campuses and the closing of some branch campuses, how have that impacted smaller rural communities?
Yeah, so the branch campuses were not doing well a few years ago. Their tuition has been frozen for 12 of the past 14 years. There's rising costs and all the sorts of challenges that colleges across the country face. And UW System President Ray Cross said in the fall of 2017 that if the system did nothing to the branch campuses, they probably would have run out of cash by now. So he proposed this restructuring that would merge some of these branch campuses with the main four-year campus. And so it previously used to be sort of a statewide network, and now it's affiliated with the main campus. System officials are optimistic that this is helping them in this, declining enrollment period. They can sort of lean on the main campus through this hard financial time.
Yeah, and how have you watched that play out with faculty, staff, and students?
You know, the campus leaders say that in the day-to-day operations, it's not any different. Students don't really notice a difference other than, the name of the campus that they're attending has changed. The day-to-day hasn't really changed. Faculty I've talked to, have some specific concerns about how the campus is being run. It's sort of coming from the main campus. They have less freedom. For example, in recruiting students, there's like a recruiting team that works for the main campus and the branch campuses, and they sort of bring students to any one of those, and there's no one advocating specifically for their campus.
So that is a concern. Josh, broadband is an issue across many rural areas of Wisconsin. Some people would say, hey, the world is your oyster. You can get your college online. What do you see there happening in Wisconsin?
Yeah, so I know UW is looking to expand their online offerings. But like you mentioned, broadband is an issue throughout rural parts of the country, and that's no different here in Wisconsin. So it's still going to be challenging to be able to access those online options, and to assume that those are going to be plausible alternatives for everybody just isn't realistic.
How do outcomes look there, too, when you're doing an online degree program detached from the heartbeat of that campus? You're not living on campus. Maybe you've never even visited that campus.
Yeah, it's varied. It's hard to know exactly, and it's going to depend on each individual student, how well they're able to acclimate to online learning, but also being able to acclimate or integrate into a campus is really challenging.
Well, let's take a call now. Melissa is joining us from Black River Falls area this morning. Hi, Melissa.
Hi.
What's your situation like? What's your story with higher ed?
Well, I'm a non-traditional student. I live in a rural area, and in fact, I'm on my commute right now to the Eau Claire area, to the tech school there. And I commute 5 days a week. It's anywhere like 50 miles one way to get there. Plus, I have an internship that takes me to Menominee, so, another 25 miles beyond that. And I'm just wondering, you talked about the decline in enrollment of traditional students. That's probably going to put later in life a non-traditional student, if they don't go right after school. And so are there things in the work to make it a little bit easier for these non-traditional students like myself to get to school? I mean, I try and maintain a full-time job. I have a household to take care of. What are some options besides the online that you already touched about? I mean, are they trying to work more night stuff, weekend programs to, help that student out?
Melissa, thank you for sharing your story. Melissa is going through a lot of windshield time here to get access to her college. Josh, what do you make of her story?
It's not uncommon, I think, unfortunately. So we know for one that our college population is increasingly diverse, and that's looking at socioeconomic background, that's looking at age of the student, that's looking at racial backgrounds. So our college students are increasingly diverse. So colleges must adapt, and. In order to reach these students successfully, they have to find ways to offer more, like Melissa said, perhaps more online options for students, perhaps more ways to maybe do blended learning. So having some times where you're in the classroom some days, online other days.
Kelly, what do you hear from Melissa's story, commuting 50 to 70 miles each day, layering on household and internship?
Yeah, I know that the UW system is increasingly going after non-traditional students because of the declining pool in traditional students to recruit from. One of the new big things that they've launched is this software that they say, you know, will help with the college advising process and helping students before they drop out of college, sort of like getting indicators that will help reach them and keep them in college, you know, despite, you know, the life challenges that they may have going on outside of school.
Sounds like Melissa is saying here that a lot is stacked against the non-traditional student, that if they didn't get in when they were that 18-year-old, that this is going to be really difficult to achieve that college degree. What, you know, where do we go from here, Josh, with education deserts?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, so I have to thank Jared Colston, one of my colleagues also who worked on this project with me within the lab. And he and I talked a little bit about this and what is a solution. It's really challenging to know, like, if a branch campus were to close, what exactly would happen, or what these communities really need to be able to provide accessible college. There's not a great perfect answer right now, and I think that's going to be something that higher education researchers and administrators definitely need to zone in on and be able to provide options for the increasingly diverse students that are coming to college.
How could small communities advocate for their higher ed needs? What could they do more to say, hey, we need something more local here?
I talk to people in the communities where the branch campuses are located, and, you know, none of them want to see their campus closed, as some of them that I talk to are talking about the county board or city investing more money, you know, and sort of sprucing up the campus. A lot of these buildings are fairly old, and they think, you know, newer buildings will attract, you know, students to their campus. So they think that that could be one sort of fix.
Do these branch campuses have housing, or what are the housing situations like? Because we are seeing such a commuter population.
Yeah, I mean, it varies for each branch campus. Mm-hmm. I know some of them do offer housing. You know, there's just like one dorm or very few dorms, but it has a very different feel than, you know, UW-Madison or other four-year campuses.
Josh, have we looked outside our state borders as to what other states do with their education deserts or how they approach this issue?
Yeah, I haven't individually done that work yet, so I can't give you a great answer, unfortunately. But you know, looking at our neighboring states, Minnesota, Minnesota has a little bit of a different system than Wisconsin, and having two state systems of higher education between the University of Minnesota and then the Minnesota State Colleges and Universities, and I think the key thing is going to be able to provide access because students stay close to home is being able to provide broad access. So getting into communities and providing unique programming to show that college is possible and that there are resources for students to get to college.
Kelly, how concerned are UW officials about the possibility of these education deserts?
Their response to me, they're not too concerned. I mean, they said they're not worried by the enrollment, even though it's the lowest that it's been in nearly half a century. They said that their applications are up about 17%, I think, for next year at the two-year branch campuses. So you know, and with the merger, a lot of these campuses have started offering new programs that they weren't able to under their previous accreditation. So they're pretty hopeful that this restructuring has given these campuses new life, and there's no talk of closures, they say.
Josh, in the last few seconds we have here, where do you take the research from here? What do you want to do with it next?
Yeah, that's a wonderful question. I think we need to continue to hammer in on sort of the nuance of what these education deserts mean for the communities, and then look at more specifically what the demographics of these colleges are, the places that that are education deserts. What do the students that go to the schools that are within them look like? I think that will be really important.
Well, Josh, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
And Kelly, thanks so much for being here.
Thanks, Kate.
Kelly Meyerhofer is the Wisconsin State Journal's higher education reporter. Josh Bach-Hansen, doctoral student who's studying access to higher ed at UW-Madison. And we have a link, by the way, to Kelly's reporting on rural education at wpr.org/mornings. Coming up, we talk about how we can put our food waste to good use through composting and learn how worms can help. That's coming up right after this news update. Stay with us on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Be sure to join us next hour for analysis on Super Tuesday results. That's coming up in about 25 minutes. Right now, though, we're looking at a person's livelihood in Wisconsin, collecting food waste from restaurants to make nutrient-rich compost and helping businesses move toward zero waste. Do you compost? Have you heard of the zero waste movement? What questions do you have about composting? And where do you put your food scraps? We're at 800-642-1234. Donna Yost owns New Turning Point Farm in the village of Krivitz in northeastern Wisconsin. She also owns Vermicopia. It's a company that collects food waste from restaurants in the Green Bay area, turns it into compost, and she joins us from our studios in Green Bay. Donna, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning. I'm so grateful to be here.
Well, let's get right to collecting these food scraps and leftovers from some restaurants in Green Bay. How is it going?
Oh, it's great. They make a lot of food waste.
So take us on your journey of collecting the food waste. How many businesses do you go to? What do you find?
Sure. So we have five. There's Luna in downtown De Pere, Luna in Bellevue, Nectar, Glass, and Carvana. And most of them we've established where I can go and get the buckets without having to worry about when they're open. And depending on which location, there may be more buckets than others. It's definitely what they're producing in the kitchen, coffee grounds, things that go into sandwiches, bananas, fruits. Nectar is a organic juice bar, so they're doing a lot of fruits. And we weigh the buckets when we go to collect them, and then we bring them clean buckets, so we're able to track how much they're producing. It's pretty consistent. Carvana and Luna are doing about 300 pounds a week. Glass and Nectar, about 100 pounds. And then Great Harvest Bakery is also in that 100-pound range, so it's significant. That's every week.
So hundreds of pounds that you're collecting each week. What happens to this food waste at your farm? What happens?
So I have 1.5 million cohorts or minions. They're my worms. They're red wigglers, Eisenia fetida. They're the best composters, and they eat their weight each day. And the compost is in windrows, so because we have such a large amount, and I take it to them and they do their job.
And so they do their job. Like, what about the snow? Is this indoors?
It's all outdoors.
Okay.
The composting process, that rotting process, gives off a lot of energy. So the other day when it was like 20 degrees outside, we stuck a thermometer in there just to check the temperature, because the worms are very much like us in what the ranges they like. if we're cold, they're cold. And they work best when they're comfortable. And the compost pile, when we put the thermometer in there, was 75 degrees, even though it was 20 outside. Yeah.
So there was a lot going on in that compost pile. Mm-hmm. What is it like to keep up the compost pile or the system, or how much do you have to tend to it?
Right now, because of the weather, it's more about plowing to keep access to it.
Okay.
Once we get to warmer weather and we start to actually do something with it, it could just sit out there. We could just keep adding to it because it goes down as it's decomposing. But we want to take it to the next level, so we use what we get out of there in several ways. There's the actual compost, which is that nice black dirt. And then there's also worm castings. And the worm castings are the most complete fertilizer that's most readily available to plants. So when you're spreading it out there, the plants can absorb those nutrients immediately. There's all kinds of great microbial life in there. And it's great for soil tilth and the structure of the soil. It's just a superfood.
Yeah. So when is the superfood ready? How do you know that your compost is ready to be used for all of these other types of things?
So you would you can put it in your hand, and it's very much like the dirt. The castings themselves, which is the worm poop, is different. They're much more granulated. They're going to be more like a coffee ground kind of consistency, and you can separate those out so that you're can actually have just that as a dressing, like a fertilizer.
We're talking with Donna Yost, owner of New Turning Point Farm in the village of Crivitz. She also operates Vermicopia. It's a company that collects food waste from restaurants in the Green Bay area and De Pere, turns it into compost. You can join in with your composting questions, 800-642-1234. Do you have a backyard garden? Or if you don't, do you still want to save your food scraps for someone else to compost? Do you feel guilty about all the food you're sending to the landfill? Join in at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Donna, I want to take a look at these worms for a moment, these red wigglers. Do you introduce them to your farm? How do you get them there? What, or did they originate there?
So 10,000 years ago, when the glaciers came, they wiped out all of the native North American worms that we have. So in the southern part of the United States, where as far as the glacier push wind, there are native worms there. So everything in this northern part of the hemisphere are all introduced. Most of the worms came during the colonial period when people were bringing plants from Europe. They, in the ballasts of ships, they would fill that with dirt. And so there are eggs, worm eggs and worms in there, and those have got introduced. Today, you can buy them at a bait shop. You can get them from a worm farm like me. You don't have to have them. The red wigglers, as I said, are the best composters, but any worm is going to be doing the same process. They release nitrogen, so if you pick them up, you'll see they're kind of slimy. That's all nitrogen in there, and so that's really good. The bigger ones are going to help to break up soil. So if you have a lot of clay soil, I call them earth breakers. They're going to burrow through there and make nice tunnels to create air pockets where water and nutrients can collect.
And you're kind of curating your worm population, your worm helpers.
Mm-hmm. And they lay a mature worm will lay 2 to 3 cocoons a day, and there are 2 to 4 BB worms inside there. So they're really good at making sure that you have more.
Well, let's go to Katie now, joining us from Wauwatosa with a question. Hi, Katie.
Hi.
What's your question?
Well, we have a compost bin in our backyard. We put our food scraps in there, but my husband also likes to collect the grass clippings when he mows the lawn and puts them into the compost bin. And I'm wondering how much grass clippings is appropriate to put in your compost bin?
My philosophy is put as everything in there and as much of it as you can get. When you don't have worms, that slows the composting process down. So if you're finding that you have at the end of the season, because things do slow down in the cold weather, you can add some worms. You can put a cover over it. The darker the cover, tarp, then that's going to raise that heat and increase that composting process. But again, if you have worms, they have their comfort zone. They'll go farther down to get away from too much heat, especially in the height of summer. So cooling that down helps them keep that process going.
Yeah, and how about Katie's leaf piles? How do those help break down in a compost pile?
Oh, the worms love those. That's one of their favorite foods. And again, the variety of things that you put in there helps to create better nutrients from different varieties. So just like we want to eat different kinds of foods for our nutritional level, the variety of things that you put into your compost help to create a greater variety of nutrition in your compost.
Katie, thanks for the call. Let's bring in Bill now in River Falls. Hi, Bill.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for taking my call. Just quickly by background, I work for a company that does corn-to-plastic technology for industrial compostable plastics. So I have some knowledge in this area. But for home composting, my question is, 75F is much too cool to control for pathogens. And I hear that's a concern sometimes with home composting. So how do you control for that? And do you avoid meat scraps in your compost if you home compost?
Great questions.
I heard that can be a source of pathogens. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Bill. Let's start with the meat scraps. What do you see there, Donna?
Absolutely. He's correct. So that's generally the rule of thumb. No meat, no dairy, because that's requires different curating of the compost. And good hygiene practices are always important because right now we're not doing a lot with our hands in the compost. But washing your hands after, you definitely don't want to be eating it, right? And those covers, you can raise that temperature.
In the covers, you're talking about covering your compost pile to control for that microbial growth. What can you tell us there?
So it helps to raise the temperature because the heat is it's not being allowed to escape, and it increases the temperature in there and then kills off bad bacteria.
We're talking with Donna Yost, our guide to all things composting. She owns a company that turns food waste from the Green Bay Area restaurants into nutrient-rich medium for growing things like crops. Are you concerned about all the food you're sending to the landfill? Do you have questions about how to compost, especially during these winter months? Does your city or town have a composting program? How does it work? Join in at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas@wpr.org. Back in a moment with Donna Yost right here on the Ideas Network. It's a conversation about composting here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Thanks for being here. So composting is an environmentally friendly way to create healthy soil for our landscape. And according to the DNR, more than 200 state-licensed composting facilities are in our state. So do you? What questions do you have? Join in 800-642-1234. Donna Yost runs a composting business in the village of Crivitz that works with area restaurants. And she stays with us. Let's go back to the phones now. Mary is in Oconto Falls this morning. Hi, Mary.
Hi.
What's your question?
I was wondering, I have a horse manure pile, and I'm wondering if I should add worms to that or not. And also, I have a question about coffee filters. I put those in my manure pile when I compost it. Is that a good thing or a bad thing?
Oh, you're doing all good things, Mary. And yes, you can put the worms in there. If they don't like something, they'll move.
What about those filters?
They're fine. They'll break down. We do that as well. That's part of the process. We're always trying to push the envelope to see what else we can add to our compost. And so we have little experiments running as far as parchment paper, napkins. Apparently, the worms really love newspaper.
Hmm. So what works well in a compost, and what have you found in your little experiments that just didn't break down?
So the compostable straws and spoons and those kinds of things take longer, but so far everything is going through and breaking down at great rates and looking good. Trying to get the right mix there.
Sure. Let's go to Matt now in Duluth. Hi, Matt. What's your question?
Oh, hi. Thanks for taking my call. I've got some birds in the backyard, and they're great for gathering up eggs and stuff, but the other big byproduct that they have is lots of manure. And I know that it's too hot to put on plants. So what are the, like, best practices for handling chicken manure and compost as far as, like, material and timelines and stuff like that?
So I like to take my chicken litter and put it around my fruit trees. Then you're not you don't have to worry so much about it being directly in contact with your, say, vegetable plants. And the USDA recommends like 120 days before the last time that you apply any kind of manure dressing, and then when you harvest. And so by putting it around the fruit trees, I'm not putting it close to anything that's any kind of vegetables. Otherwise, you can just let it sit, turn it, and then once it breaks down, then you can add it to your vegetable plants or something that's going to be in closer proximity to something that you're going to eat directly.
Matt, does that sound like a plan to you?
Yeah, that's great. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you. And, you know, Donna, what is the zero waste movement, and how are you helping Green Bay area restaurants get there?
So zero waste, I feel, is an extension of the what I grew up with, which was reduce, reuse, recycle. B. Johnson really popularized it with a home blog that she started for her family in the early 2000s, and she actually wrote a book and with practical steps of how to do that. And she adds two more R's, and I really like these two R's. And zero waste is a philosophy. It's a thinking about your intention of what you're doing when you're purchasing and that life cycle of what you're purchasing or whether you're going to purchase. So her first R is refuse, which I think is a great way to start your philosophical endeavor in this. And her last one, which is one of my favorites, is rot. So it's a cradle-to-cradle philosophy rather than a cradle-to-grave, which is much more linear. And then you're just kind of stopping at the end and you're burying it and you're done. And cradle-to-cradle says you're going to think about what's going to happen at the end of this particular item's life cycle. And how along the way are there things that you can do to make sure by the time it gets to the end of its life cycle that it really is at a point where it's being utilized in every way? So in terms of rot, right, the food waste is returning back to the soil.
Completing the cycle.
Mm-hmm.
We're talking with Donna Yost, who goes by Farm Her Donna. She owns the compost collection company Vermicopia and a company that collects food waste from area restaurants, turns it into compost. With your questions here at 800-642-1234, are you composting at home? What are your questions, your challenges? Let's bring in Kelly now in Cascade. Hi, Kelly.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I work for a company in North Milwaukee, the Horizon Home Care, and we have a green team, and as a part of that team, we collect all of the organic waste, so coffee grounds, orange peels, banana peels. We just have a receptacle, and people can put their organic waste in there. I then do my 5-acre farm, and it gets thrown in a huge heap, which is our official compost, unofficial compost heap. And at this point, it's just a huge heap. At the end of the, like in the spring, we usually take it and scatter it around the garden and then till it in before we plant. And I'm wondering how, like right now in this big heap, how to, last year, a bunch of vegetables ended up springing forth from the leftover compost. So we had tomatoes and zucchinis and eggplants all growing straight from the compost itself.
Oh,
so
wow.
I know that's not well managed, but I'm wondering kind of like how to get it going to the next step. What's the few things that we can do?
Well, I don't. I think that's great that there's things growing in there. So that is part of that heat process that we were talking about earlier, and getting it up higher to kill off, and then basically those seeds won't germinate. So I would maybe section, instead of one big pile, maybe have two piles. Years ago, I thought to myself, why am I dragging compost into the garden? And so I started a new process where actually I take the compost, and I like concrete block. And so I'll put the bottom row of the concrete block where it's the solid side out, and then put a row where the next row with the open side out. And then you can wrap that in wire if you want to for the critters. And then, you know, keep building up. It doesn't have to be super tall, but put that right on one of your plots in your garden, and you could divide that up since you have so much. So you could do like two or three, and then just move that each season to the next place in the garden. And then in that spot that you had where everything was decomposing, you've got all that great juice that's gone in there. You've got everything that's decomposed, and then whatever didn't decompose over the winter, you can start in your new pile. So you're basically just moving two walls over, and then moving that all through your garden, and that saves on having to haul it over there. But I would split the pile up to make sure that you're able to get it hot, and then do put a cover over it to keep that heat in there.
Yeah, spreading the wealth. Kelly, thank you so much. Let's go to Judy now in Milwaukee. Judy, hi.
Hi there. I apologize. I tuned in late, but I heard you say add worms to a horse manure pile. And my question is, there's some research now being done saying that if you're adding red worms, you're displacing the natural species of worm. And I'm wondering if you have any comments on that.
So during the last ice age, the glaciers that moved down, they wiped out all of our native worms that we have here in the northern part of the United States and Canada. So we don't actually have any native worms left up here, but there is some controversy about that. They do talk about how, because the worms do like to eat things, that how does that impact forests? So there are some studies around that. So
So we'll just kind of
you're not really displacing native worms, because we don't have any here in this part of the world, you know, we're having them in our gardens, and we're not necessarily taking them out into the forest. So I think that they do good things.
Well,
that's
Donna,
my personal opinion.
Yeah, Donna, thank you for joining us.
Thank you. It's been such a pleasure. I appreciate it so much.
Donna Yost owns a composting business collecting food waste from restaurants in the Green Bay area, helping them move toward zero waste. She joined us from our studios in Green Bay. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show. You're listening to the Ideas Network.